Are you ready to proceed? May it please the court, opposing counsel. I'm Kevin O'Neill. I represent the defendant in this matter. Represented him below in consideration with a number of things that happened to him procedurally and substantively that have landed him behind bars. I think this case is an interesting case for many reasons. I think it provides us with fertile ground to look at what the Superior Court is doing down below in connection with these VOP proceedings. I refer to them in my reply brief as shotgun weddings. I believe that's what they're doing down there, lumping a recent charge with a probationary violation together, where the defense counsel walks in and gets a take it or leave it offer, oftentimes for 5, 10, 15 years of his life, and if he doesn't like it, oftentimes he can suffer severe penalties. That's what happened to Mr. Jenkins in this case. I think it's also an interesting case because it really brings into perspective the exclusionary rule within the context of probation violation hearings. Based on some legislation that I added, House Bill 50, was it? I think I included the synopsis, and what the synopsis to that piece of legislation, which is 2 or 3 years old, tells us is that in Delaware, roughly 30%, about 30% of the people now in our correctional systems get there because of a violation of probation. So the Superior Court is dealing with a huge mass of people who are behind bars because they have violated, as Mr. Jenkins did in this case, probation. Which brings into sharp focus whether the exclusionary rule should be applied to probation.
Mr. Wiley, help the court understand how we get to the substantive issue of the exclusionary rule. It seems to me that when the motion was presented at the first violation of probation hearing, the motion to exclude, suppress, and then your client didn't show up and it was dismissed, and then your client has a second violation of probation hearing, and the motion is not renewed, and then he's found to be in violation of probation, that's the end of the inquiry. The fact that in a subsequent criminal proceeding, the same evidence was suppressed, tell the court how that subsequent proceeding is a basis to undo the first proceeding when you had an opportunity to raise the motion twice. And it wasn't pursued.
Well, let me add to Justice Holland's question. In the motion that was filed on October 28th, it recites, Mr. Jenkins does have a good suppression argument and did not believe he would waive it in his underlying case, merely his VOP case. Doesn't that simply constitute his admission and concession that this substantive issue, that is a suppression motion with respect to the VOP, was waived? So you've got three procedural hurdles to get through, and I think they're all lined up, and I think an answer is appropriate.
I'd like to address that, Your Honor. There's two questions here. That's a very good one. I want to look at the language I used in that motion. If I wrote that, I may want to take that back, and I mean that. I don't mean to be disingenuous or unfair intellectually, but I want to look at the language of that. But I'd like to return to Justice Holland's first question, and then the second one. I filed a motion to suppress the evidence within the context of a violation of probation hearing. It was filed 8 days before the hearing was supposed to take place. That motion did not request in its relief or in any way address the underlying case. I showed up with my client, received what we believe to be a harsh plea. He couldn't handle it emotionally, and he left the courtroom. I went into the courtroom, and Judge Silverman shared with me his thoughts. He said, first of all, Mr. O'Neill, you know, we're here on the VOP Fast Track Day, and I've consolidated the larger case, which is a trafficking case, with this violation hearing. And I kind of knew that, but there's no order about that. And my motion didn't address that. There's no consolidation order. So
well,
when I filed...
Wait a minute. There's a case management plan that talks about these fast tracks, and that's published by the court, isn't it?
Well, I realize that, but is there a consolidated order that governs this issue? There may be a game plan to process these cases together, but I wasn't aware when I filed the motion that a ruling on my VOP suppression motion would govern the later motion.
I'm not suggesting that. Right. But the fact that you had the two events, an opportunity to case review both of them at the same time, that's in the case management.
And I knew that coming into the courtroom.
My understanding of the record is, in fact, the ruling on your violation of probation motion to suppress didn't control the criminal proceeding because you prevailed in the criminal proceeding on the motion to suppress.
That's correct. Your Honor was asking me why I didn't renew the motion. That's because Judge Silverman told me the motion is denied. Part of the state's argument in this case. And when a judge tells me, Mr. O'Neill, I've heard enough from you, your motion's denied, thank you, I don't know where that leaves us. I don't feel...
Well, it's denied for failure to prosecute, right?
For failure to prosecute. I disagree with that because I tried to withdraw it. I was on my feet. I was trying to be nimble there to protect the client's rights. He couldn't handle the plea offer and left. And I thought, well, why don't I just withdraw it and maybe when we pick him up, we can bring it in and I can present it again, after all. He's not here. When he's back, maybe we'll present it again.
Did Judge Silverman abuse his discretion by treating the motion as abandoned because your client absconded? I mean, what standard do we use to review what he did?
It was an error of law, on the other hand, or an abuse of discretion for him to do that? I guess I would argue... I don't want to be critical or overcritical of the judge, but I argue that he made a mistake, that he should have let me withdraw the motion. That was in my power to present it. It's in my power to withdraw it.
Isn't it in his power to say defendant skipped? It's abandoned?
The defendant didn't abandon it. There was no willing and voluntary right for him to abandon it. What Judge Silverman did is punish the client and said, if he leaves, we're going to deny the motion. But in terms of him saying, coming to an intellectual decision, I abandon that position, I no longer want to take that motion, I no longer want to present the motion, that was never done in the case. There was no voluntary relinquishment of his right to present the motion. He just walked out of the courtroom.
So you're saying that Judge Silverman was wrong to have done what he did, but what standard do we use in reviewing that, and why was he wrong to come to the conclusion that he did?
Well, if it's an abuse of discretion standard, I don't want to be unduly harsh at the trial level or of the trial level judge. I think it was an error for him to not let me withdraw my motion. I think that in civil proceedings, customarily in civil cases, motions are passed. Attorneys routinely say, I'd like to pass on this motion, represent
it. What kind of error? Legal error, plain error,
abuse of discretion? I would say legal error for him to have done that.
Well, he knew your client had left when he denied the motion. Right. And we have a lot of cases that say if you flee from justice, abscond the jurisdiction, whatever, you forfeit your rights. And it appears that what Judge Silverman was saying is he's not here. This was the time. He's forfeited his right, therefore the motion's denied or dismissed, words to that effect. Is that what he did?
I think that's what he did.
So then what you're asking us to do on appeal is say that notwithstanding the undisputed fact that your client fled the jurisdiction or left the courtroom, however we want to characterize it, somehow the judge made it a legal error. Is that correct?
That's correct. I would say that. I don't want to feel like I'm put in a position to have to make that argument, but I would say that. Is it fair when people flee the courtroom on the eve of trial for the Superior Court judge to find them guilty in absentia or
Well,
and that's a whole other
we
issue.
We had a case in the last year that talked about a person who didn't like the way the closing arguments went and didn't come back for the jury's deliberations and to render their verdict. And we held that it was proper for the court to proceed without the defendant under those circumstances.
Isn't that a case where the case has already been tried?
Yeah.
What's different if the person leaves the courtroom before the case begins and the court says, by the way, you've left the courtroom, you've waived your right to present evidence in this case, we're going to find you guilty. It's a little different. My fact pattern, I would think, is more like that than when the case has already been tried. After all, you're just waiting for the verdict to come
back. We have cases that say if you flee the jurisdiction following your conviction, you can't take an appeal.
Well, were you prepared to present evidence even with your client gone on the motion to suppress? It was your motion. So were you ready to go forward without your client?
I'm thinking back. I'm trying to think back, and I'm putting myself in front of Judge Silverman. The officer was there. I remember that. I was going to put my client on the stand. I was, which is very unusual in a VOP proceeding. So without him, I couldn't have gone forward. I was going to put him on the stand. I was.
Well, when you say without him, you couldn't have gone forward.
Well,
without him, you would not have wanted to go forward.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. I think my ability to succeed would, to some degree, have been impaired. On the case in chief, I didn't put him on the stand. When we replayed this scenario in front of Judge Babiarsh for the underlying case in chief, I didn't put him on the stand because I felt the testimony went so favorable for me that Judge Babiarsh, after Trooper McColgan testified, I felt it was so favorable for me that Judge Babiarsh would rule in my favor. So I don't recall that I put Mr. Jenkins
maybe
on the
stand. Better take some of your time to get to the substance of your argument and why you believe that exclusionary rule under the Delaware Constitution should apply in violation of probation.
Well, there are really two issues, and the state didn't respond to my primary argument, which is that a man's in jail. He may have served to put himself in jail because he left the courtroom. I understand that. My fallback issue on that was that the procedural protections for someone within the context of a violation of probation hearing are very, very skimpy. It's one thing if I go to court in a trial and I've received a plea agreement. Mr. Jenkins, here's 12 years. We've got a trial 2 months from now. You either take it or not. We have a case review. You can discuss it with your matter. It's another thing if I show up at a VOP fast-track proceeding and, so to speak, the plea is sprung on me at that time. It's sprung on me. I don't have any discovery. I don't know what my witnesses are. They slide it across the table. Hey. 10, 12 years, take it.
Oh, wait a minute.
To some degree.
You had
I'm
an
overstating
opportunity
that.
To ask for a second hearing if need be. I mean, it's not like things are, you have the opportunity to ask for relief if you're not, don't have enough time to consider that offer, don't you?
No. I mean, that would be a discretionary thing. I mean, if I made a request and the judge could say, well, I'll consider it. But for the most part, when you're there, they say, does your client want to go forward or not? Is he going to accept the offer or not, Mr. O'Neill? If not, if he's not going to accept the offer, we'll schedule for a trial. Generally, that's sort of, if he wants to go forward, we'll go ahead and forward right now. I mean, the courts and the Superior Court, the judges treat that differently. Some will give you some time, some will not, to consider that.
Did you ask for more time?
I didn't ask for more time because he left. He left the courtroom. Actually, I wanted to withdraw it. I was sort of backpedaling to get time to maybe bring him in, to have him think about it, to go forward. But in addressing the substantive question of the case, I notice my argument number one is that it's a traditional argument, and Justice Hollis wrote about it in your book, that we, when it's all said and done, we have someone in jail where there's been a clear deck for 6 years, 4 years served, where there's a clear declaration that he's there because of illegal police conduct. It's an unusual fact pattern. It's really an unusual fact pattern. Everything has to line up to get us there within the context of a probation violation hearing. And what happened is, when I looked at the state's brief in this case, there was no response to my central argument that Delaware has an elevated state constitutional tradition that requires a constitutional remedy of exclusion. And if the court accepts, there was no response. If the court accepts that position, I didn't receive a response by the state in their brief. The fallback position is that let's forget about whether in fact a constitutional remedy is required by a constitutional violation. Let's talk about deterrence. And in this case, I would be happy to talk about deterrence. I think that applying the exclusionary remedy to probation hearings, which our Superior Court is loaded with, I think it's something that an individual should have. I think it would deter police conduct. The governor's task force, it's a terrific title, basically says, suggests that state constitutional rights can be moved out of the way. I believe that. There's a reason why Department of Probation goes out with the state police. They work in tandem together. The notion of a probation officer in Delaware, at least some of them, that's part counselor, part overseer of whether a guy's doing good things, part someone who can provide services, that's much different than probation officers dressed in battle fatigues, with blue, armed with guns, big yellow letters, blue vests, who come and knock late at night. This is happening quite a bit. The court doesn't see this. I hear it from the clients, not Mr. Jenkins. I hear it all the time. And under those circumstances, they're acting as law enforcement agents. And if they're acting as law enforcement agents, the exclusionary rule should apply. And it would deter them. It absolutely would deter them. I would think, and I kind of overstated this, because I don't know if many police really believe that if they break a probationer's constitutional rights, the evidence will be thrown out. I suggested that police know that. I think some probably know that. Some don't know that. But a lot of probation officers out on these jump-out squads, they know it. When they're going out with the police at night, they know that even if they violate constitutional rights, they still got him because he's on probation for 3 or 4 years and they got him with drugs, so what's the big deal? I believe the Department of Probation knows that, at least those individuals who are conducting these kinds of searches with the police. And they're vast. This isn't like a parole violation hearing or
let's assume for the sake of argument that the United States Constitution doesn't require that the exclusionary rule apply at the violation of probation hearings. I ask you again, cite the portion of the Delaware Constitution that mandates that we conclude that the exclusionary rule in Delaware does apply to searches made by probation officers with or without the assistance of the state police.
It doesn't. My answer is it doesn't explicitly. The only thing I can rely on, there's out-of-state cases now from Washington, from Colorado, from Florida, where they are using the state constitution and they're construing it to give individuals greater rights to prohibit the use of unconstitutional evidence within the context of probation hearings.
Does it hinge on the tandem you referred to, this combination of probation officers and police officers? Or does it also apply to an investigation that results in an illegal search that's conducted solely by and in the course of probationary supervision?
Well, I think that would depend on how the probation officers acted. If they're armed with guns and they're acting like police, they should be subject to the same requirements of the police. I think if I understand Your Honor's question.
Okay, so if someone reports, as they are obligated to do to a probation officer in the probation and parole offices, and the probation officer says, open your pockets, put everything in your possession on my desk, and the probationer does, and there's a rock or crack cocaine, does that violate the exclusionary rule?
He signed a contract. The probationer has signed a contract under which that conduct is authorized. He permits that.
Right.
Now, in this case, so getting back to your question, under those fact patterns, no, I don't think that this.
So we're back to your point earlier that only when they're acting as ersatz or pseudo police officers or in tandem with police officers.
That's correct.
That's your position?
And in this case, the probation officers didn't make the stop. Corporal Scott McColgan did, of the Delaware State Police. In other words, he actually got information from them and made the stop and pulled up and pulled Mr. Jenks out of his car and searched him immediately. So it really, in this case, it's more of a state trooper violation, a conventional violation, rather than the Department of Probation. They were sort of in the background, but working with the individual. My central argument is, do we want to? And it's something that the court has written about. Do we want to provide constitutional protections for a violation of constitutional right? And if this court says we're not of a mind to do that, we'll go with the majority. I think that really that position has nothing to do with the concept of deterrence. It's kind of an assertion of human dignity and human rights. It has nothing to do with the cost-benefit analysis. I like the argument number two. I think under cost-benefit analysis, I think it makes a lot of sense to send the police a message. Because we have so many people now on probation in Delaware. We have people on probation. They stay on probation forever, almost. We have one of the highest probation populations of any state in the country. And under these fact patterns, where people are having their rights violated, I think, in such numbers, I think it wouldn't be a bad idea to let the police know. And, of course, it's always hard to defend somebody who's a drug guy.
When you say they stay on probation forever, SB 50, cut back.
I tried to address that. I mean, we're moving that direction. I mean, I'm on the Russian front when I see it in the Superior Court, but we're moving that direction. That was a wonderful step. A wonderful step. We have people who are getting drug treatment and anger management, but they can't even work. They can't pay child support. They're all probationed up. They can't live. I always tell the Superior Court judges, I'm on a tangent now, give them 30 days, 90 days, 6 months, cut them loose. But that's another issue. But we do have a large population now. We have a large population of people, and arguably a certain percentage are having their rights violated. The police know about it, and I think a ruling on this point, where we clearly have established through a strange confluence of events a violation of someone's rights under these circumstances, I think it would be a wonderful opportunity for this court to make some new law. And either under the concept, which was never addressed by the state, under the concept that I think I'm over my time.
Only if you want to save the balance.
Right.
Is that what you're working on? You have 2 minutes and 45, 44, 43.
I think I'll save it. I'm sorry.
I'll save it to you, man.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you very much, Chief Justice. Thank you.
If it please the court, generally in appeal we're dealing with a decision by a Superior Court judge the defendant doesn't agree with, and I can't find one. Judge Silverman, actually we have three Superior Court judges here, Judges Silverman, Judge Herlihy, and Judge Babiarz. Judge Babiarz, of course, granted the suppression motion. That is, the only ruling Judge Babiarz made was in the defendant's favor. Judge Herlihy was never presented with the issue at that violation of probation hearing. That's Judge Herlihy's finding of violation is actually the order appealed from. That's when the defendant filed his notice of appeal, but at the violation of the probation hearing, the defendant conceded that the unobjected to testimony of the police officer who found the drugs on him established that he was in violation of his probation. So that really can't be the ruling appealed from. And Judge Silverman, at the first violation of the probation hearing, when the motion to suppress was actually before the court, and may or may not have been entertained by the court. We never got that far. The defendant decided to abscond.
Well, let's focus on that for a second. If we were in a trial context and the defendant absconds, the judge doesn't direct a verdict of guilty. You've finished the process. So why is it not an abuse of discretion to deny the motion simply because he left? Why shouldn't the judge have said, all right, Mr. O'Neill, client's gone, but this is the time set. Call your first witness.
I'm not quite sure that Judge Silverman denied the motion for all time. After Judge Silverman finally said, I'm going to deny the motion for failure to prosecute, he said, where that leaves you, I don't know. And before saying that at the end, I mean, there was a rather lengthy discussion.
Let me ask you on that, to clarify that failure to prosecute issue. Is there something in the record from defense counsel saying, I cannot go forward, and therefore he denies the motion? Or is it just he walks out the courtroom and then the judge says, I'm denying it for failure to prosecute?
I don't think the defense counsel ever said that specifically, but defense counsel never said that he wanted to go forward either. I mean, that just seemed to be a given, that since the defendant himself had absconded, nothing was going to happen that particular day.
What's your understanding of what was on the schedule for that day with Judge Silverman? And was it only the motion, or was it the violation of probation hearing, and with the understanding that prior to conducting the hearing, the motion would be heard, or was only the motion?
Judge Silverman was a little confused about what was going on because the suppression motion had no case number on it. There was a suppression motion with the defendant, state versus defendant, but it was unclear from the motion itself whether it dealt with the underlying, the new criminal charges or the violation of probation hearing. And like I say, because the defendant absconded, that was never really clarified. The motion was never heard. Judge Silverman.
What else was on the docket for that day?
I'm sorry.
What else was going to happen that day besides the motion?
It was it was a violation of probation. Was my understanding that was what was scheduled for that day was the violation of probation hearing.
And what was the allegation of the violation at that point?
That was that the defendant was arrested on new charges. The new charges being the new drug offense and the evidence for which was later suppressed in December by Judge Babiarz. That was the primary allegation of violation of probation. There were a few minor.
Do you think Judge Silverman would have found him guilty of a violation of probation had he been able presciently to know that at some later time the drugs that were the basis for the arrest and the conviction were suppressed?
Well, it depends. Then Judge Silverman would have been faced with the issue, the merit issue, of whether a violation of probation, or whether the exclusionary rule should apply to probation violation hearings. Then there would have been a decision on that issue, of which there was none in this case. I mean, the underlying merit decision was never presented to or decided by any Superior Court judge.
Well, I understand that was an option. My question, I suppose, was a more practical one. And that was, do you think a judge would have found somebody in violation of probation on the basis of an arrest and a prospective conviction if he knew that the drugs that were the subject of the arrest had been suppressed and that there was no conviction? Would he have violated his probation simply because he was arrested for a charge but later on he was not found guilty of?
Well, he wasn't not found guilty. The evidence was suppressed. There's no doubt that he was guilty of the underlying charge. But the exclusionary rule is not a ruling on guilt or innocence. This is that we're not going to use the evidence, and in this case, the evidence. So, yes.
The consequence of suppressing the drugs, at least in my limited and long-ago background, is you can't convict somebody of a drug offense if the drugs are suppressed.
Correct.
Has that changed somehow?
No, but that is not the rule as to the violation of probation. That's an extension of the sentence, the original sentencing hearing.
Yeah, and my question again is a practical one. What judge would find somebody guilty of a violation of probation under a drug offense if that person was never convicted of it? Would they find him guilty simply because of an arrest?
Yes, that's what happens. As a matter of fact, I mean, the defendant had been convicted of this charge when he was found in violation by Judge Irving.
That explains why 30% of the arrestees are on probation and coming back.
Well, that, again, is a policy decision for the Superior Court to make, whether they want to find violations based on new charges before there's been a trial on the new charges. I mean, that's for Superior Court to decide.
So as a practical matter, you suggest to me that they would routinely find somebody guilty of a violation of probation because they'd been arrested, even if they weren't convicted of the crime for which they were arrested?
Yes. Okay. Yes, they do that now. And it was done in this case. The defendant had not been convicted, and in fact, the evidence was later suppressed by Judge Babiarz. And again, on the merits, like I say, this court in Bruton, the Bruton case, in the context of parole violations, citing to the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court case, Pennsylvania Board of Probation and Parole versus Scott, the main case, held that the exclusionary rule does not apply to parole violation hearings. Those courts throughout the United States, those state courts that have held now, since.
In Bruton, this court never mentioned the state constitution, did they?
No. No, it didn't.
It was strictly a claim raised under the United States Constitution, and we adhere to the holdings of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes.
Not surprising.
Yeah, this court never mentioned, never did an analysis under the state constitution.
Aren't parole hearings fundamentally different? I mean, you'll have ultimately the issue of whether there's been a violation, but you don't have law-trained people presiding who can rule on motions to suppress and apply the Constitution, and you don't have a court involved. So doesn't that distinguish them from violation of probation proceedings where you've got a court involved with the ultimate sanction being the same as if somebody had potentially gone on trial for this offense? I mean, isn't there a fundamental difference?
Well, as far as the ultimate consequence, certainly a violation of parole hearing has the same kind of consequence. Go back to jail. You violated your parole, you go back to jail. But what Your Honor mentioned, the other distinction, certainly. I mean, for a violation of probation hearing, you're before a law-trained judge and you're represented by lawyers, or a lawyer, and the state's represented by a lawyer. And as a practical matter, there's no reason why you can't have a suppression hearing. The other side of the coin, and a rationale used by courts in rejecting the exclusionary rule in this context, is that it's an extension of the sentencing hearing, and that the judge, the sentencing judge here, should have at his fingertips to decide whether there has been a violation, all of the relevant facts, whether or not these facts would be admissible in a criminal trial. Again, it is a sentencing hearing rather than a trial. The consequences, again, may be severe, and I don't deny that, but probation is an act of grace, like parole, and the alternative. It's not that the defendant is getting more time than he could originally have. He's just having the grace of being granted freedom, limited freedom, taken away from him because he has violated the terms, violated his contract, violated his agreement with the judge.
Well, we've gone to great length in many cases evaluating whether there were reasonable grounds or reasonable suspicion to conduct a search of a probationer, and have set the standard for that consistent with the U.S. Supreme Court decisions and our own. So what is the remedy for a violation of that standard? The defendant is to bring a monetary claim. That's what you're suggesting?
Right now this court has not spoken on the issue, so I'm not sure what the remedy is.
Suggest one. I
can say that the majority of courts that have considered the issue have decided that the judge should be able to consider, in the violation of probation, all the relevant facts, and that the exclusionary rule does not apply. Now, the sentencing judge obviously has a great deal of discretion in whether to violate a probation or not, and what the sentence should be. I mean, this is not an area in which the sentencing judge is at all cabined by minimum mandatories or anything like that. The judge can be whatever
But you answered my question by saying what they're going to do is violate the probation and sentence based on the arrest, even if the evidence that was the product of the arrest is suppressed.
And if
suddenly all that discretion has appeared that wasn't there 10 minutes ago, as a practical matter.
Well, I'd say as a practical matter, the judge can, I think I see what Your Honor is saying, that that as a practical matter, the judge can fashion any type of sentence that the judge wants, and the judge can very well take into account the circumstances surrounding the arrest on the new offenses, and may very well take into account the possibility that this defendant in the future may get the evidence suppressed when it comes time to try on the new offenses. But it's the state's position, certainly, that at the base level, in considering whether the defendant has violated his probation, that judge should be able to consider all the evidence. And as a practical matter, I mean, this is like a bench trial. The judge is going to hear all the evidence anyhow. the judge is going to know from the suppression hearing, if one is held, that the defendant was found with, in this case, you know, X amount of drugs in his pocket when the defendant had been sentenced previously for possession of X amount of drugs.
There is no remedy, or is there a remedy, for even if he is found in violation of his probation, as you're suggesting should happen, is there any remedy for the violation of his rights under the Fourth Amendment or the Delaware Constitution? Or let's focus on the Delaware Constitution. Is there any remedy, assuming there's a violation of his rights?
No, there's no specific... In the context of the violation of probation hearing, there is no remedy in the sense of a exclusion of evidence. I'm saying that. Now, whether he can sue under a 1983 action or something like that, I mean, that's neither here nor there as far as the criminal case goes. But as far as a total remedy in the sense of excluding evidence and not allowing the judge to consider the violation evidence, and the judge being basically, in a case like this, forced to find that there was no violation of probation in the face of the fact that there was an obvious violation of probation, no, there is no specific remedy as to that. And I suggest to the court, nor should there be. The defendant was... they're bold enough to, while on probation for trafficking in cocaine, to go around with cocaine in his pocket. Well, he's going to pay the consequences for that, those actions, even though he may get a buy on the underlying criminal cases due to the exclusionary rule.
Now, we heard from opposing counsel about difficulties arise from probation officers working in tandem with police officers, and I don't want to unfairly summarize that argument, so I'll leave it at, should we be more concerned under factual circumstances when probation officers are working with police officers on the theory that if we were to suppress evidence, if a police officer was making an illegal search, when a probation officer is either acting as a police officer or acting in tandem with police officers, shouldn't we be equally concerned?
Well, as a practical matter, under these task force they have, the probation officers and police officers routinely go out together. And the reason for that, primary reason for that, is to have a uniformed officer nearby, or at least a trained police officer, when things get a little dicey, basically for the protection of the probation and parole officers. No, I realize there's a great deal of consternation on the part of the defense bar about probation officers now acting a lot like cops, especially when they go out on these task force. That's some kind of a policy thing, and I probably have my own feelings about that, but they're neither here nor there.
Well, they're here. They're here.
They're here.
If the policy that we're concerned about is whether or not their pretextual search is made in order to excuse the higher burden that would apply to police officers on the state of grace theory that we apply to probation.
Right.
That's the concern.
The issue that does come up in that context is whether or not the police are using the probation and parole officers to make an end run around the Fourth Amendment. That's the issue that comes up. And certainly if the court, the trial judge, suppression hearing judge, realizes that that's the case, the judge can deal with it at that point and say, no, I'm not going to apply the lesser standards that are due to probation and parole officers for conducting warrantless searches or...
Is that in play in this case at all?
No. The Judge Babiarz went and just said, look, based on what the officer knew when he arrived at the Wawa, he just did not really have reasonable suspicion to approach this guy start asking him questions, which eventually led to finding the cocaine. So it was a straight Fourth Amendment analysis that Judge Babiarz used.
I take it since the state did not appeal that ruling,
you
agree with it?
No, our failure to appeal does not necessarily mean that we agree with it. It just means that would be a fruitless appeal, that it's a matter of discretion, if you will, that I can't say that Judge Babiarz was just dead wrong, appeal, come before this court and say, Judge Babiarz was wrong because bang, bang, bang. No, he wasn't. I mean, he applied the right law. He just didn't like the way it smelled. And, all right, that's fine. It could have gone the other way, but it was certainly not an appealable decision.
Well, does the judge have, even though there's not a mandatory exclusionary rule in your view, does the judge have discretion if he doesn't like the way it smells to not consider
at the probation hearing?
Yeah.
I don't see why not. Judge could just say, again, judge had very broad discretion at this stage. Judge could say, look, you know, I realize, Mr. Defendant, that you violated the terms and conditions of your probation by having drugs on your bed, but quite frankly, you know, on the other hand, you know, I don't like the way this case smells either, so I'm just going to continue on probation. And, boy, you better not do this again, because next time, whether it smells or not, I'm going to send you away for a long time. The judge can do that. That's up to the judge. That's up to the judge.
Should we be concerned if 10 of the Superior Court judges are doing it that way and 9 are doing it the other way?
Well, again, that's up to the Superior Court.
We should be concerned?
Well, that's up to the judicial system. I'm not a member. But if the court has no further questions, I...
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
May it please the court, opposing counsel.
Can I ask you something right out of the box? Do you agree that at a sentencing proceeding, at the original sentencing proceeding, that the sentencing judge could consider illegally seized evidence that may not have been part of a motion to suppress in that case?
Can he?
Yes.
Well, they do. They do. They've always done that. That's the current status. I must be misunderstanding the question.
Does that violate the Constitution, the Delaware Constitution?
Oh, they all do. Every single Superior Court judge says, Mr. O'Neill, I mean, we want to do this in a VOP hearing. You want me to exclude evidence?
About the VOP. I'm talking the original sentencing hearing, the original time after a pre-sentence investigation. The pre-sentence officer reports.
Assume the original conviction.
There was another case.
Okay.
That happened at just the same time or about the same time. Evidence was suppressed. All that's disclosed. Judge looks at that and evaluates what the sentence should be, even though that evidence would not have been admitted in a separate trial. Can he consider that?
Well, he can consider that. He has broad discretion. They don't. If I understand your honest question.
The BOP hearing is an extension of the sentencing hearing. Why can't he consider it at the BOP hearing?
I'm dense on this. I'm missing the point. If we're at a VOP sentencing now, or sentencing on the underlying case, the VOP sentencing.
Well, let me try and rephrase. My question is, can a sentencing judge at the time of the original sentence?
VOP. VOP.
The original sentence.
Okay, on the underlying
first
case.
First time he hasn't been sentenced, can he consider evidence from another case that had been suppressed in deciding what appropriate sentence to apply in this case?
I suppose he can. I don't see why he ever would. You're saying, would he consider another?
Well, it might show a propensity to commit a lot of crimes, even though they couldn't convict him on this other case.
With the same defendant, you're saying you got off on the earlier one. I'm going to consider that now. I'm going to, even though I got off on the earlier one, I want to just in my own mind in fashioning this sentence.
Well, let me try it one more time this way. Assuming he can consider it at the original sentencing hearing, why should a VOP hearing, which is the same process of imposing a sentence, any different?
I don't understand the question. I really am missing. I'm really sorry. I really am. I'm really sorry. I'm missing that question. I would love to have that set forth to me. I want to say just one other comment in closing. I've got 20 seconds here.
I'm over.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything to say. floor, the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attention to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned.